Our last case today is Hennis versus Himlick. Mr. Allen.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Eric Allen. I represent Timothy Hennis. May it please the court. This case really is about one of the most important instruments that we have in our legal system, something that has protected citizens for hundreds of years and was only suspended for the period of the Civil War. The writ of habeas corpus provides that individuals who are detained of their liberty unconstitutionally can get redress from pretty much any court in the United States. There's state habeas corpus petitions. There are federal habeas corpus petitions. In this case, we filed a petition pursuant to 2241. That was because the petitioner was not in state custody. He wasn't in federal custody necessarily.
And your client is in custody of the military?
Yes.
And was at the time you filed?
Yes.
Was he held in the brig?
No. He was...
Was he under house arrest? He was called back into service.
He was called back into service. He wasn't under any restriction. He could go on leave. He could...
Well, he wasn't. But you're saying that's custody?
Well, he was brought back in order to be court-martialed.
He was brought back into the military. He was activated, wasn't he?
Yes. He was reactivated.
He was activated into the military. But the 2241 says you have to be in custody. You're challenging custody. And you got to be, it's got to be custody in violation of the Constitution or laws of the United States.
Yes.
What constitutional provisions you claim were violated by him being in custody?
Well, the fact that the military lost jurisdiction over him pursuant to the Hirschberg case.
Was that a constitutional claim?
Yes.
What constitutional provision?
Well,
I didn't find, there's nothing in your petition that I saw. That's right. I'm just trying to figure out what you're claiming here, where your claim arises, is what I'm getting at.
In terms of,
The 2241 says constitution or law.
Right.
If you don't have any constitutional claims, there's got to be a claim under some law in the United States.
Right. Well, there's the Fifth Amendment, which is the right to due process. There's, jurisdictional requirements for the military in order for them to try the petitioner. They first have to have...
But you're the jurisdictional requirements in order to be somebody, court-martial somebody.
Yes.
So you're challenging that too?
Yes. I mean, that's the whole basis of our petition.
Is to challenge the court-martial. So you're challenging an application of a law in the United States as opposed to a constitutional claim. Or are you rolling a constitutional claim in there?
Well, I think they both apply.
Do you think, well, but you haven't said it. I just, all I'm trying to do is articulate.
Are
you claiming double jeopardy?
No.
Not claiming double jeopardy.
And I had a
due process. Anything else?
No.
Cruel and unusual punishment? Claiming that?
Well, no, because this was before the court martial and you can't have a Eighth Amendment claim until after.
All right.
Been tried and then,
so you're claiming, all right, you're claiming violation of the jurisdiction by the military.
Yes.
Right.
And I think the facts in this case are fairly straightforward. They may not seem like, but if you look at...
Don't you have to show, though, to get into 2241, you'd have to establish that being activated in the military is equivalent to being in the custody of the prison warden.
Yes.
Because the statute says in custody.
Yeah, I believe he was in custody. He wasn't.
So he was in custody. In jail. He was on active duty, but yeah. He was in custody.
Yes.
Okay.
Before he was activated, what was his status?
Retired reserve.
Reserve. Yes. So he had a contractual obligation to fulfill a reserve requirement. Was he in active drill status?
No.
Reserve drill status?
No.
No drill. All right, so. What was his contractual obligation? Just to be ready reserve for callback?
Yes.
Could he have refused that? and just be like in it, like the draft dodger said, don't take a step forward. Because if you don't take a step forward, there's no military jurisdiction over you. You just be prosecuted under federal laws for failure. Could he have done that? He said, I'm not coming. I got your letter, I've torn it up. Now, I'm a civilian. So, whatever laws exist, prosecute me in a civilian court.
I think that creates another set of legal issues for the petitioner.
I think that legal issue is going to really be one whether or not, in fact, that you can question whether or not you unconstitutionally in custody when you answer the reserve. When you answer the reserve, you become active status. Do they give military jurisdiction?
No.
Dead?
No. I think in terms of what status he was under, those relate to any actions that occurred from the time he reenlisted until the time he was done. This occurred in 1986. And the military judge made a specific finding, and that's part of the joint appendix here, that his end of his contractual obligation was in 1986. He was not discharged from the military until 1989. This is a classic Hirschberg analysis.
But those claims, as Boyle said, need to be dealt with in the military system, right?
Right.
And you're dealing with them in the military system, I assume, right now. So forget about all these underlying potential issues. Isn't this whole thing somewhat premature?
No.
Well, what could we do? Because you just told us it's ongoing in the military.
It is.
And you may get from the military court exactly what you're claiming you want here.
If I may.
Isn't that right?
No. Eventually. That's
you
possible.
May get the relief you're seeking here from the military court, and you're in fact seeking it from the military court right now.
Well, they haven't completed the record, as far as I know.
But you have a right of, rights of appeal.
Yes.
Through the military system.
Yes.
You have a right to petition for certiorari to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes.
Okay.
I think
you have remedies in the military court system.
Yes. I think that goes to the essence of the abstention question that was.
Goes to the essence of it.
Yes. I think you have to look at whether or not, I think the government wants you to see councilmen as absolutely mandatory. In every case that involves the military, they have to step, the federal court has to step aside. It can't get involved. And they cite the fact that military expertise is required in every case. But I think this case is far more simple than the military lawyers and the U.S. attorney make it out to be. The problem becomes...
What's our standard of review?
For which? The
summary judgment? Issue that you're bringing up here, whether we affirm the district court, do we review his decision for abuse of discretion, his decision to abstain?
Yes, his decision to abstain. His decision to grant the summary judgment is de novo, as well as his decision not to grant the petition for habeas corpus. In terms of the abstention doctrine and whether or not this harm is ordinary, I'm not aware of any case in the history of the United States that has similar facts to this, where a person is convicted in state court in North Carolina. The Supreme Court reverses it because of prosecutorial misconduct, because of judicial overreaching. He is retried and acquitted. The military decides some 25 years later that they're going to retry him. And he is retried, denied basic due process during that retrial, convicted and sentenced to death a second time.
A retrial is not a problem if the military has jurisdiction. in terms of the scenario, clearly you could be tried and convicted and acquitted in state court. Military has jurisdiction on you. You could be tried there again.
Yes.
But that's not the problem. And, and the problem that you have is you say there's not jurisdiction because you say there's a break in service that, that allows for it. But then we've got this court of military appeals case that essentially says that if this contract hasn't ended and he's done this purposes just for to get back in, then they retain jurisdiction.
Yeah, and I imagine that will be the majority of the government's argument, dealing with the final pay and things like that. But all of that is irrelevant to this. There's no...
to the court of military appeals decision? The Clarity case, wasn't it Clarity? Judge Robertson wrote
Clarity,
that case?
Yes.
Judge Everett?
Yes. I'm aware of that case.
Are we bound by that case?
Yes, but I don't believe that applies to him. Because... go ahead.
Because?
Because his ETS, as found by the military judge, was 1986. His discharge date was 1989. 1986 was before 1989, so the Hirschberg, I mean, it's a really simple analysis. What complicates things is the military is trying to impose regulations that don't apply in this case, because no regulations apply where someone is convicted, reversed, and then acquitted. There's no regulation that applies to that.
So. Now, getting back to Judge's earlier question regarding the councilman distinction, isn't that a determination can be made by a military court? And you got the appeal to that very issue that you bring up that will deal with whether there was jurisdiction. Goes through the whole review process. You're going to have counsel appointed, represent him all the way up the line and have an opportunity to go before a service court and then go before the Court of Appeals Armed Forces. Then ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court. Then if you finish that, habeas.
Sure.
I mean, isn't all that in front of you?
Yes, but here's the problem, if I may. The problem is...
What I want to know is, what you're about to say fit within an exception to that?
Well, I think that when...
What is the exception?
Well, I think the exception is what the harm is to the person that's asking for the relief. I mean, that's one of the...
What is the harm?
What is the harm? Well, if he is right... he has been sentenced to death a second time. He has to be taken away from his family. He has
to... The case law said that's not enough? That the fact that you face prosecution and you can go to jail or things bad could happen to you, that's not enough to put in and of itself, because everybody would face that possibility. So,
I mean, in an ordinary case. I mean, the Supreme Court in the United States... time and time again has said death is different. This is not a run-of-the-mill court-martial. This is not some guy getting drunk on leave and, you know, robbing a liquor store. This is
an execution at this point. I understand how it all works in the process of it, but everything we've just said, death is not going to occur before that whole process occurs and even before the opportunity to present ultimately a habeas petition. So, I understand the urgency of the death situation itself, but it's not like he's going to be executed tomorrow or the next day or now. That is being held until it goes through the entire review process.
Well, certainly I think it becomes sort of do they have a right to hold him at all then? If they don't have jurisdiction, does he have to wait the, 5-6 years before the record gets complete?
And a question that can be answered by the military courts. And unless you are saying that they are incapable of doing so or that you can't possibly get, and that might be an exception. If you had a court that absolutely did not have competency to do it and you could prove it, you might have an exception there. But I don't think you've got that. Do you?
Well, I think you're asking the fox to watch over the hen house when you're asking the...
Well, there's a ready-made process there. We're not an appellate court from a military court-martial.
Correct.
But that's what you're trying to make it. You have a right to habeas corpus. As a matter of fact, Judge Boyle said he ruled without prejudice. Right?
Right.
Well, you means you can go back. If we affirm him, you can come back at some point, I assume, if you need to.
Right.
But
You've got avenues for relief built into the system. Separate and apart from this. I mean, we don't normally get people up here from a state court for proceeding where they're saying, we want to abandon the state court process and have you say the state court doesn't have any jurisdiction.
Hey, counsel, I'm surprised you abandoned the Eighth Amendment entry when Judge King asked you, because in a sense, you could argue that the military could turn this into a life sentence just by delaying it forever and forever and ever and say, well, we never get to the protection of the Great Writ because we're not finished with it yet. I mean, there are all kinds of scenarios, it seems to me, that you could argue in terms of you arguing a constitutional violation, because in theory is, that is, again, I think for the very instance, civilians, military, that I'm a civilian whisked off the street by the military, forced to go into their court. I want the Great Writ because I'm coming to a federal court saying they have no right to have me there, period.
Well, I think that's why I cited either in the brief below or in the brief here, the Hamdan case, which is similar. I mean, it's no different. Mr. Hennis is no different than these so-called enemy combatants.
It looks like he's getting less rights than they are.
Yeah, and I think he is in this situation, again, that's never been challenged before.
Let me make sure I understand here, at least an issue here. If he is on active duty continuously for 20 years and then he retires and goes into the retired pool, doesn't matter if he's a civilian for 100 years, you can call him back to active duty because of the 20 years. Is that right?
Yeah, but you can't. You can only.
So the break doesn't apply to that after the 20 years. What you're seeking is the break in that 20 is the jurisdiction.
Right. If this.
You're saying one day in 1989. Is that right?
I would disagree that it was one day. I would say it was 3 years.
All right. But you only needed one day.
Yeah, I mean, unless you want, I mean, Clardy says if you just reenlisted during the time of active duty, I mean, that doesn't count as a break in service. There was a distinct break in service designated by the judge, the military judge in this case, is 1986. This wasn't challenged by the military. They didn't say, wait a minute, judge, that's not right.
Only when we get the military would be better able to answer that question correctly than we would.
Well, I think you handle contract cases all the time. This is a contract case. The contract ended in 86. He signed a new contract in 1989. Between that time, there's no.
Let's see what the government's got to say about it here.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Mr. Wood?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. If it pleases the court. My name is Seth Wood. I represent the respondents in this appeal. This is a case about timing. It's not so much about the writ as petitioner's counsel was talking about. We're not disputing, obviously, that at some point when this process, the military process is played out, the petitioner can file a 2241 and even bring this jurisdictional challenge in whatever the appropriate forum is at that time. Here, though, the petitioner's brought a collateral attack against a non-final court-martial proceeding. It's a proceeding where he hasn't exhausted his available remedies, and he hasn't completed his direct appeal process. And as the Supreme Court in the Councilman decision, as this court in the Dooley decision, and as other courts of appeals have held, the district court correctly abstained from interfering in a pending court-martial proceeding.
Could we also analyze this under the Younger extension?
In Councilman, the court essentially took Younger and applied it to the military context, and then that's kind of how this Councilman abstention has come about.
It seems to have been a distinction. The Councilman, at least they talked about equitable considerations, which was not Younger, and then the Chief Justice concurs and said he'd just do it under Younger. So I'd ask your expertise on that, but I think I see where you're going.
I understand. And in Councilman, The language that's used by the court on page 758 of the opinion is that courts, quote unquote, must refrain when the petitioner can show no harm other than that attended to the resolution of his case in the military justice system. And they laid out the reasons for engaging in this kind of abstention to allow the courts to apply their expertise. In this case, we're talking about military courts to apply their expertise and their experience to allow a record to be developed fully, to allow the issues to be considered, possibly resolved as those proceedings go forward, and to have them refined so that when you have upper-level review or when you have collateral review, you've had as much consideration as you could to kind of whittle the issues down so it's not that we don't have any extraneous questions sitting around.
Are there exceptions?
I haven't found a direct exception applying councilman directly, expressly.
Certainly exceptions to Young.
Yes, there are.
Would those exceptions apply here?
They would not. Younger requires extraordinary circumstances. I think that's one of the exceptions. As the court held in councilman, simply having to go through the military or the prosecutorial process, being prosecuted, although that may be difficult and injurious, that's not enough to warrant being able to go around the.
So that goes back. That's why I asked the initial question: could we do to Younger? Because then we'd have the exceptions. But now you're telling me that no councilman gives a different type, or at least a stronger extension based upon the expertise of the military. Is that where you're going?
Well, it is somewhat. The court. I'm not going to say that there's absolutely no exceptions to the councilman, because frankly, there could be a case that does that.
Sure, found a court that was absolutely corrupt, and you knew that the evidence would show there's no way you could get in justice from it. That might be one.
Sure.
But there's no evidence of that here, of course. Okay.
Well, follow up on that. If the person was charged as here in civilian crime and acquitted, in the military police, for example, the shore police picked them up, and they had a trial for it, there will be no remedy, right? They have to abstain.
Well, this is a question where we'd have to look at some of the cases the petitioner cites from the 50s. Like we have the Toth opinion, which is a little different. But then you've got also the McElroy and Reed. The question I have is, when you have councilmen, which postdates all those opinions, what do you do, you know, when you apply them together?
Right.
I honestly can't say for sure exactly what the outcome would be in that situation.
It would be no remedy. We'd have to abstain because there's an ongoing military tribunal.
If there was if the court adopted a complete, exclusive, broad reading of councilmen, but that's not this situation. There's no dispute that the petitioner's susceptible to recall, that he's susceptible to being recalled for this court-martial. So he's in military service.
He's in the military service now?
Yes.
All right. Is he being held in custody?
He is. Out of, yeah.
Pardon?
Yes.
Okay. What's the status of the military court-martial proceedings?
The court-martial has returned a verdict, imposed the sentence, but right now we're at the step above that with the convening authority, which is the stage where the record's finalized, the parties can seek post-trial relief.
You're in post-trial proceedings?
That's correct.
It's not on appeal?
Not yet.
When will it be on appeal?
Once the convening authority has.
Is there a time frame for that kind of thing?
There's
no final judgment then.
There isn't yet.
In the federal court system, with no final judgment until you finish those post-trial proceedings.
That's right.
So you don't have that.
We don't have a final judgment yet from the convening authority. Now, the convening authority has broad powers to.
Which effectively is a level review. He could dismiss this whole thing if he wanted to. Grant this very relief.
He could.
And then from then it moves on up the ladder. But along the ladder, it's even greater protection than being in a civilian world. Because you got a convening authority can do everything that the court can do all the way up the ladder, and nobody ever can question it, which is amazing in and of itself.
That's right, Your Honor.
And the defendant can seek, during that proceeding, to ask for all kinds of remedy, including clemency and all kinds of other things from that convening authority.
But he didn't have a right to adjourn his peers.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I said he didn't have a right to adjourn his peers when he was tried and sentenced to death.
He was able to request an enlisted panel within the court martial.
A military jury.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's not what he would have in terms of being a civilian, would it?
Well, sure, the military panels are different than a jury out in
very much different
than district court, sure.
Right. That's a big difference. And that's what the Great Writ was meant for in terms of this to me it goes to the question of the balance of powers. I know these judicial creative things, councilman and abstention, but we do everything we can to somehow step away from our authority in terms of our obligation to federal court, this branch, the independent. We're an executive branch, really. Right? Military is. And what you just told me is that they could whisk a person away who has never been in the military and try them. And there's nothing we could do until they're finished with them. The Great Writ would have to stand at ease or stand down. Is that correct? That's what you told me. You didn't know of any remedy they would have. If he had never been in the military and they just took him, what could we do?
Under councilman, we said, well, he's in it. What would we do?
The court would have to look to these earlier cases that created councilmen and decide how they intersected, whether councilmen controlled more closely, whether they were ruled.
That's not what the district court did. The district court said, look, military, you're in the military court, I'm abstaining on the council. Period.
And it makes sense that he would, because here we have an individual in service. He's been recalled. This isn't the person who's been whisked off the street who was a civilian. We have someone who's in service. He's receiving benefits, retirement benefits. And pursuant to the UCMJ, he could be recalled for this very purpose.
For purposes of being tried on offenses that occurred while you were on active duty.
Correct. Yes, sir.
Not for offenses that would occur after he got off active duty, but only during that, for instance, 20-year period.
That's right, Your Honor. He went out and...
So the limitation is there's no opportunity for someone who's never been in the military to be called to the military for an offense because you are, for instance, you're in a retired status or that sort of thing, or a reserve status as a reserve officer. This guy was active duty for 20 years, and it's those offenses during the 20 years that the law allows, and that's just being a retiree. There's nothing he can do about that, unless he didn't want to receive benefits, I guess. He could probably renounce it.
That may be the case, Your Honor. But your summary is...
Which would be interesting in and of itself. If an individual who was retiree would decide he no longer wanted to be a retiree and refuse the benefits, and then the question, that's another question.
Mm-hmm. Going to this discussion about Councilman and Younger, in Councilman, the Supreme Court actually talked about some of these interests that I referenced earlier in terms of that these are reasons why typically you defer to state proceedings and allow those to go forward, or administrative proceedings and allow those to go forward. And the court actually held that those interests apply even more strongly in a military context for two different reasons. One, that the Army or the military, of course, has a very strong interest in maintaining a disciplined, effective fighting force. But secondly, that Congress has stepped in and created a legal regime through the Uniform Code of Military Justice that attempts to balance that interest with the rights of the service member, service man, service woman. And we can see this in terms of the available process. Judge King, you asked about some of that earlier to petitioner's counsel. We're with the convening authority now. Because we have a death sentence at play, if the convening authority doesn't act on his broad power and allows this thing to go forward, he'll get a mandatory appeal. I don't believe it's discretionary. I think he has to take it. The Army Court of Criminal Appeals. If the petitioner loses there, he has a mandatory appeal to the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces. That's a civilian court with members appointed by the president. So it's not as though we're going through essentially one type of review with one type of overseer. We're talking about different types of courts with different types of people. Once that's done with, of course, then he has the right to go to the Supreme Court, and he can bring extraordinary writs within the military system. Once that's done, or he can follow 2241 in this situation. So there's a lot of processes available to the petitioner. This court in Dooley.
During that process, can he bring claims that are different than the ones he's bringing here? He's not going to be barred. There's no exhaustion rule that's going to preclude him connection with what he raised here, is it?
In terms of the military process?
Yes.
I believe he would be able to bring a variety of claims in the military.
Bring whatever he wants to bring.
I think it's a general trend.
Why would that be the case when in courts, we all the time in state courts, and if you fail to exhaust, and we take those up when you come here on the 2254 petition, why all of a sudden there wouldn't be potentially exhaustion problems that would linger into his case when he came here? You didn't get another free shot at everything. Certainly there are procedures. Sure, you're going to argue all kinds of exhaustion or the lack thereof. Will you not? You answer that question as if it's like a new trial, all issues, nothing is weighed, nothing is, no question of exhaustion or default.
I may not understand the question, so I will try to explain my understanding.
Now, I want to make sure that the military wouldn't hold him to what he's raised here now.
No.
If he comes and he can raise whatever he wants there, and then when he comes back here, or if he ever comes back here, it'd be a different thing.
Yes, that's correct.
Because I don't think, for example, he's articulated an Eighth Amendment claim. He says he didn't raise a double jeopardy.
He does not.
He says he might have a due process claim, but I haven't seen any due process. I haven't seen any constitutional claims in his petition.
And then the better answer maybe then is not abstention. It's a matter that he hasn't raised jurisdictional or writ for the Great Writ. That might be the answer to the case. But if it's bereft of all of those things, then we don't have jurisdiction to even consider the writ. You don't plead, though. Mm-hmm. Not abstention, mm-hmm. if that's the case.
But he says he's raised a violation of the law, Title 10, that military courts don't have proper jurisdiction of, which is a question of law, of the statutes, statutory interpretation or application. But it's not a constitutional issue, I don't think.
It's not.
And but the Great Writ is for, or the writ here, 2241, custody in contravention of the Constitution or laws of the United States.
Yes. And to be frank to Judge King, that the jurisdictional question as to 2241 has not been briefed fully in either side's brief. So if the court would like supplemental briefing on any of that, we'd be happy.
Pardon?
We haven't addressed, frankly, that 2241 question as far as jurisdiction in the first place.
Well, everybody's talked about 2241. You all got, he talks about 2041, you talk about 2041, mm-hmm. the district judge talks about 2041, but I couldn't find where, mm-hmm. what claim under 40 point is brought under 40, under 2241. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find what it was, but whatever it is, he can keep going. The judge has said he can exhaust his remedies in the military system. And what Judge Boyle did is granted judgment without prejudice. That's pretty clear, I think.
Yes, Your Honor. That is what he granted.
Let me ask you regarding counsel on this case. The defendant is represented in the court martial proceeding. Is he represented by a detailed defense counsel?
I believe that's correct. But
is he represented by an individual military counsel as well? A counsel of his own choosing?
Yes, Your Honor.
So he's got two other military counsel, and is this his private counsel in the military proceeding?
In this habeas proceeding, I
want to know in the military proceeding, is this his private? Does he have a private counsel, or is this just for the habeas proceeding?
I think Mr. Allen's just for this habeas proceeding, but I could be wrong, and I'll let him correct me. From what I've seen from the joint appendix, I don't think I've seen Mr. Allen's name on any of the petitioner's briefs. With the military court.
Me, because you have a military counsel at your table, is this the trial counsel on the case from the military proceeding?
No, Your Honor.
This is a staff judge advocate or someone who's associated with?
He's with Army litigation.
And I bring that up because there are serious important concerns about representations of defendants. I'm not saying they're implicated here, but it would seem in a setting of this sort where you've got a collateral proceeding in which you have an attorney-client privilege in the military proceeding and they are not here. And I'm not saying they even can be. I'm just saying it's just interesting to me. But yet and still, you can bring the staff judge advocate in, you know, from the convening authority's perspective. This is the person who writes the review to that convening authority we just talked about. And I guess it's not your question, but usually the government does bear a burden in terms of representation for defendants in the situation.
And he, as you say, as the appointed counsel, Within the military system, this habeas counsel, I let Mr. Allen address it. I don't know the details of his relationship.
All right.
The model here, in terms of abstention discussion, is with the Willenbring case that we cited toward the end of our brief on page 24. And I call it the model because it applies this whole councilman idea in practice, where we have an individual who alleges a jurisdictional basis through 2241, but he brings it after he's exhausted everything else and after he's gone through the military system. And then he brings the 2241, he goes before the district court, and then this court reviews it. So I would just, although the substance of Willenbring we discussed a little bit in our brief, it's actually more just interesting because it shows how councilman plays out in practice. We think it's how it should play out in practice here.
Even if we find councilman abstention here, there may be that opportunity at some point in time we'll get into these questions of whether clarity should have been applied here, whether there was a break in the service. Ultimately, that issue, you think, could come back to this court someday in the form of another type of petition, maybe a habeas, and then we will get to the merits if we apply councilman abstention then.
Yes,
sure. He doesn't win down along the way.
That's right. That's right. The relevant appellate court, wherever he files his habeas, would have a shot at reviewing that habeas or 2241 at that time.
It becomes somewhat confusing because we spend time, as we must, looking at those very issues on the merits, but the purpose of it being is to determine whether councilman abstention should be applied. And that's why I go to the question of what is the exception? Because I think we've got to fit if within an exception, if we find councilman applies, to then move into the merits of it. And
absolutely.
Wasn't that clear in terms of what the exception is, other than you just think that there probably is one?
I acknowledge the prior precedents, the prior cases before councilman. I acknowledge Younger has some exceptions. I acknowledge that this is a...
But you don't think those Younger exceptions apply?
I haven't found it in the direct context of councilman. That's the limitation. That's my hedge.
I'm trying to figure out a reason why they wouldn't apply. I mean, the Younger one with extraordinary circumstances that, you know, make, right. I mean, the same consideration, because Younger deals with a state court.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, even though it's not a military specialized court, state courts tend to know what state law is all about, and you tend to defer to them if there's a state interest. And one of it is, you know, in determining there's a significant state interest, you need to get it in the first instance. And of course, there's a military interest here, but it would seem the exceptions would be just about the same.
I understand the court's argument. If those exceptions apply, if the exceptions were to be imported, into this councilman question, they wouldn't apply. The picture just doesn't satisfy them because we don't have demonstrated bad faith or partiality on the part of the fact finder, and because there are no extraordinary circumstances, because councilman has told us what they're not. My time is up. We ask that the court affirm district court.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wood. We appreciate it. Mr. Allen?
In terms of petitioner going to the military court, prior to filing this, he did seek extraordinary writs in the military system, both at the intermediate level and at the highest level. And they were both denied as they just didn't want to get involved at this point.
One of those was a petition for a writ of prohibition.
Yes.
Which is probably, sounds like if there's a problem here, that's the right remedy. And so you're trying to, I mean, what you got is a 2241 seeking us to give you a writ of prohibition. And that's not really, according to Judge Boyle, that's not what we're supposed to be doing. But you already tried it out. You actually tried it out in the military courts.
Yeah.
And lost.
Yeah.
And that's what I was getting at. You're trying to then move over and make the district court and then this court appellate courts for the military court. There's a fixed process there. You go up through the military system, eventually to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, I think that we're not trying to make you appellate court for the military system. I think all of these abstention doctrines evolved from the sort of federal courts being uncomfortable when dealing with other courts' issues, and not wanting to involve themselves in certain situations. And sort of the, I don't want to say weakness, but sort of the uncertainty of federal courts at the beginning of the 20th century. I think now when you look at this case, when you're looking at whether or not they should abstain and whether or not these are extraordinary circumstances, I can't say it enough. I don't know.
You added that part, and whether these are extraordinary circumstances, is that the exception? You're calling out that these are extraordinary circumstances?
Yes.
Okay.
And
where does that come from?
I think that comes from the Unker. I think that's a...
Wouldn't quite say it that way, but I'll go with you.
I think it's not... It doesn't say in the opinion, this is the rule and this is the exception, but I think if you look at the case itself, I think you can read from that this is an exception to... If there are extraordinary circumstances, the federal court can go in there and take care of what they need to take care of. And again, I think this case provided not only the district court, but provides this court with the opportunity to grant relief in a case where the military lacks complete jurisdiction for these offenses. They may have jurisdiction over him for offenses that, you know, if they alleged he committed a crime in 1995. They would have jurisdiction there. But in 1986 or 1985, when this occurred, they don't have jurisdiction over him. So I guess the problem that I have is if he is to go through the Intermediate Court of Appeals for the military and he goes to the, Supreme Court for the military and he spends 5-10 years on death row, and then all of a sudden a military judge says, well, you know, Mr. Hennis, you're right. They didn't have jurisdiction. I'm sorry that we took the last 10 years of your life away from you. I think that's the issue here, whether or not he should have to wait that long for this review. And if you have no further questions, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate Mr. Allen. Appreciate Mr. Wood. We're going to come down and greet counsel.